This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Because next week in Yud Kishon we will have, instead of the Motzei Shabbos, we will have the shiur later on. It'll be a bit shorter than usual. We start at 10:45, and then we'll have tea, and then we'll go on to Slichus after midnight. And the following Motzei Shabbos is after Rosh Hashanah. It will have been three heavy days, and I don't think anyone's particularly in the mood for a shiur after that. And there's the Shabbos Shiva shiur that Shabbos as well. Why not? And the following Motzei Shabbos is Motzei Yom Kippur. I don't think anybody will be in a mood for a shiur then. And the following Motzei Shabbos is after 2 days of Sukkot. We'll have a Motzei Shabbos shiur and a Melava Malka afterwards. Sorry, that's the Motzei Shabbos of Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and my father will be here, and he'll give the shiur, and then we'll have a Melava Malka and a Simchas Pesach HaShoeva in the Sukkah afterwards. And then the following Motzei Shabbos is the day after Simchas Torah. So until Parshas Noach, except for that Shabbos Chol HaMoed, we won't be having any shiur.
And the Sundays?
Sundays will carry on as usual, just under matter one or two. But, I don't know, I think Tzom Gedalia is the one that, but otherwise we'll carry on as usual. Chazal, which make it clear that we relate to the wisdom of the non-Jewish world with a significant degree of respect. There's a bracha we make when we see a wise person, a chacham, a non-Jewish chacham. Chochma b'goyim taimin. If you're told that the goyim, the nations of the world, have wisdom, you're entitled to believe it. That could well be true. Chochma is not something, wisdom is not something which the non-Jew is in any way unable to achieve to very great heights. Torah b'goyim al taimin. That if somebody tells you that the non-Jews have Torah, that al taimin, that can't be. Which means that there is something very essentially different between Chochmas HaGoyim and Chochmas HaTorah, between the wisdom of the nations and the wisdom of Torah. Something so basically different that it makes the Chochmas HaTorah impossible to be achieved by a non-Jew, which is difficult to understand on the surface. What is it? Why can't a non-Jew open a Gemara and take a course and learn and understand it? Some of the differences are fairly obvious, but they're not necessarily the deep and essential differences of which we're speaking. One of the differences we've discussed in the Friday morning shiur, where we learn the introduction of the Rambam to Seder Zoraim, where the Rambam talks about the magnitude of intellect and of spirit and of character of the earlier generations, and how virtually impossible it is for us in later generations to understand that which went before us. Whereas secular learning is based on an assumption that each generation takes the conclusions of the previous generation and develops them further, each generation stands on the shoulders of the generation that went before it, whereas secular knowledge assumes that progress can only come from disproving the learning of earlier generations, finding the flaws in it and correcting those flaws and progressing further. Torah learning follows the opposite approach, and that we're moving from the source further and further away. Secular knowledge, as each generation goes by, comes closer and closer to an understanding of truth. But in Torah, we've never understood truth so well as we did the day that Moshe stood on Sinai. That was the one time that we really understood what truth was all about. And every successive generation has had a diminished picture of the emes of Torah, of the truth of Torah. That the Yeridas HaDorot, that's the decline of the generations to which we have been subjected all these years. But that's a difference in method and approach. That's not an inherent difference. It's a very important difference in method and approach, and it requires a different character. Whereas in non-Jewish wisdom you can survive if you're arrogant. In fact, you can thrive if you're arrogant. You need a bit of arrogance to be able to really be creative in secular learning. You have to have the guts to be able to stand up and say, my teachers were wrong, and this is why they were wrong, this is the mistake they made. That requires a measure of arrogance. As in Torah, if one has that arrogance, it isn't possible to learn, because one would start off with assumptions which are incorrect. One would start off with an assumption that it's possible that the earlier generations made mistakes perceptible to us, perceivable to us, and it can't be. There's no way that we, even if they would have made a mistake, there's no way we would be able to perceive that mistake, because we've come so far. And so it requires different method and it requires different character traits. That's true. But that's not the difference which Chazal are referring to when they talk about this vast, vast gap between Chochmas HaTorah and Chochmas HaGoyim. The Midrash in today's Sedra says, Lishmo v'la'asos is kol mitzvosoy. The blessings will come if you're careful to observe and practice, to guard and to practice all my mitzvahs. Omer Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, kol mi sheloma divrei Torah ve'inoy mekayim. Anyone who has learnt Torah and doesn't keep it, onshoy chomer mimi shelo lomad kol ika. His punishment is more severe than one who never learnt. Here we already see a vast difference between Torah and Chochmas HaGoyim. That you're better off not having learnt at all than learning and not practicing. Lema ador adoyme, to what can this be compared? Lemelech shehoyo loy pardes, to a king who had an orchard. Hichnis l'soichu shnei arisim, and he put two workers into the orchard. Echod hoyo netea ilonus u'mekatzitzam. One worker used to plant trees and then chop the trees up. Ve'echod lo hayo netea kol ikar. And one used to sit in the shade or sit in the sun and do nothing. He didn't plant anything and he didn't chop anything. Al mi amelech koyes, who does the king get angry with? Lo alusi shoyo netea u'mekatzitzam kol u'mekatzitzam. Doesn't he get angry with the one who is planting and chops down the trees? Isn't that where he expresses his anger? So anyone who learns the words of the Torah and does not observe them, observe it, his punishment is worse than one who hasn't learnt at all. That doesn't mean, by the way, that it's better not to learn. One has to learn, there's a halacha that one has to learn. But that learning creates a responsibility on one, which one cannot escape from. One doesn't have the option to say, well then, better I don't learn. No. You have to learn, the halacha is you've got to learn. If you learn, that puts you in a situation where you're worse off if you don't observe than you were before. Good, so you've got to be careful to observe. That's the only option. Why does the Medrash bring the example? The Medrash makes a statement. Anybody who learns Torah and doesn't observe is punished worse than if he would not have learned Torah at all. Finish, that's enough. What do you have to tell us more than that? Why does the Medrash have to tell us the story about the orchard with the two workers, the one plants and chops and the other doesn't plant at all? Who does the king get angry with? What does that mashal, what does that example add to our understanding of the principle that one is responsible to observe if one has learnt? That's what we're going to discuss this evening, and in so doing we will understand. We won't understand, we don't have enough time. We will gain a glimpse of an insight into an area of the essential difference between Torah and Chochmas HaGoyim. And in Yirtzeh Hashem, at other occasions, we shall have to develop it further. Some of you who have heard Shiurim for several years will already be familiar with the concept and will find it easier. Those of you who aren't, regard it as an introduction to the concept, and over the months we'll look at the same concept from different angles and it will become clearer and clearer. We learned some weeks ago in the Hakdama of the Shev Shmaitzer, the introduction to the Sefer Shev Shmaitzer, that the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world and put us in it in order that we should earn our living. He didn't want to have to be good to us in a way where we felt that the goodness was undeserved. For part of being good is leaving the other person feeling good. And it's very difficult to leave a person feeling good if one adopts a condescending attitude. If one does kindness to a person in a way which makes the person feel the recipient of charity, it doesn't leave him feeling very comfortable. We talked earlier about communal chesed in the earlier shir. If you go up to somebody and you say, "Have you got anywhere to eat on Shabbos?" He might say no. If he's very desperate, he'll say no. And you say, "Oh, then please come over to me, no problem." Doesn't leave him feeling good. It leaves him feeling thoroughly embarrassed. And that's why he's very likely to say, "Yes, I do have somewhere to eat," even if he doesn't. Doesn't want the embarrassment. If you phone a girl up on Friday and you ask her for a date on Mitzvah Shabbos, if she's got any self-respect, even if she's sitting alone miserably at home, she's likely to say, "Sorry, I'm busy." And if you say, "How about next Mitzvah Shabbos?" she's likely to say, "I'm busy next Mitzvah Shabbos too." If one wants to do the chesed, there's a different way to do it. Then you go up to the person and you say, "I'm taking a chance. I'm sure you booked up many weeks ahead. But we would really love to have you. Maybe, is there any chance this Shabbos? Or if not this Shabbos, next Shabbos, when do you think we could have you?" That leaves him in a position to be able to say, "Strange, you should ask, you know, that after the Shabbos I'm free." And he doesn't feel condescended to. So one has to be very careful how one does a chesed. Part of the chesed is leaving the person feeling independent, not allowing the person to feel condescended to. And the Ribbono Shel Olam, being as he is the essence of good, and therefore does good, because one cannot be good if one doesn't do good, and doing good means leaving the person feeling good, realized in his wisdom that if we are to feel good about the goodness he gives us, we need to earn it. And so he created the world. Shev Shmaitzer bases this on a Zohar HaKodesh. He created the world full of its trials and tribulations, so that at the end of the day we should come before the Ribbono Shel Olam, and whatever good we've been able to achieve, we should feel we deserve for it, we deserve that we've worked for it. And that was a share a few weeks ago. But does that mean that we really have no role to play here? Does that mean we're here only to be tested? That's all. Or is there somehow a contribution that we can make? It's a very difficult theological question, because if there's a contribution we can make, that means that before we were put here, somehow, as if to say, Kibiyocho Veribershon was incomplete, the Torah was incomplete, what contribution could we make? So the simple way of thinking is, no, there's no contribution we can make. God was complete, the Torah was complete, there's nothing we can do. We're put here only to be tested so that we should earn our keep. But that doesn't fit in with the whole system of Jewish living. It doesn't fit in with the kind of life the Torah wants from us. For if that's for the truth, that we're only put here to survive the tests, then we should lock ourselves up in rooms from the moment we're born, just waiting, looking forward to the moment we die, and when we finally die we should heave a sigh of relief that it's all over and that's it. And yet that's not the kind of life the Torah recommends. The Torah wants us to be active. The Torah wants us to conquer the world, to conquer knowledge, to master the world, to expand, to invent, to discover, to grow, to be involved with people, to do chesed.
So it seems that there's something more to all this test than just a test. That in fact there is a contribution that we can make, as theologically difficult as that sounds. What is the possible contribution? What can we give to the Ribbono Shel Olam? What can we give to the Torah? The Torah is an absolutely perfect self-contained system. And the Torah existed long, long before creation. There's a beautiful piece
of the Baal HaTanya that explains why it is
Chazal say
Sim Tovim Be'olam Hazeh Mikol Chayei Olam, of Tshuva and Ma'asim Tovim is worth more, is more beautiful than all the life of the world to come. Strange statement. Chaya Olam Haba, the life, the world to come. That's where the real reward is. That's where the real benefit, the real goodness is. And we're told that there's no pleasure in this world that can equate to a little touch of the enormity of the pleasures, of the thrill and satisfaction of the world to come. And yet Chazal tell us that one moment of Torah mitzvahs in this world is more beautiful than the entire world. How does that work? The Baal HaTanya says, Ki olam habo hu shenenim miziv hashchino. The world to come, what is the benefit? What is the pleasure of the world to come? We derive pleasure from our proximity to the Ribbono Shel Olam. We're close to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's a very great pleasure. That's something very deep. Shehu Tainug HaHasogo, that is the pleasure of incorporating, of understanding, of perceiving the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Ve'i efshar l'shum nivro afilu meha'elyoni lahasig kiim eizo ha'oro me'oir Hashem. Even the greatest of us can only achieve one glimpse of a tiny aspect of the Ribbono Shel Olam. It is impossible, even in Olam Haba, for any person, for any human being, to perceive the enormity of God's glory. It can't be done. It's not possible. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvoido v'atzmo, God in His full honor and in His essence, les machshovo tfiso be'klal, there is no intellect that can grasp Him. Kiyim, accepting. Kasher tfiso mislabeshes batoiro mitzviseho, azi tfiso bohemu mislabeshes bakodosh boruchu mamish. Only when the Ribbono Shel Olam is absorbed into the Torah and its mitzvahs, then one can absorb God Himself. The raisa v'kudshu bricho kulachad. Because the Zohar HaKodesh says that the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Torah is one. Not two separate units. It's not God and the Torah. There is no distinction between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Torah. And therefore, if one has grasped the Torah, one has grasped the Ribbono Shel Olam kibiyoch. And then he says, even the Torah is dressed up in physical manifestations. We talk about animals in the Torah, kosher animals and treif animals. We talk about people, Ganovim and Gazlonim and all sorts of people, husbands and wives and kings and Sanhedrins and wars. The Torah is all talking about physical things. How can that be the Ribbono Shel Olam? And he explains that if you give a person a hug, it's not less intimate if he's wearing one garment of clothes or he's wearing a shirt
and a jacket and an overcoat on top, it makes no difference to the hug. It says the same thing. You put your arms around him, you give him a hug, it makes no difference how many clothes he's wearing. So it is, if one takes the Torah and absorbs it and one hugs it, one encompasses the whole Torah, it doesn't matter that it's wearing clothes, that it's wearing a physical manifestation, that it has an outside manifestation of clothing, that doesn't matter. And the Baal HaTanya goes on in a very important piece where he says, Kol seichel kishemaskil umasig besichlo eze muskal. Any intellect which perceives and understands a concept, harei haseichel tofes es hamuskal umakifoi besichlo. The intellect takes the concept and encompasses it with its intellect. One absorbs the concept into one's mind. If you've integrated an idea, that idea is absorbed into your mind. You understand it, you've mastered it, you've, so to say, dominated the concept. And the concept is caught up and surrounded and dressed by the intellect, this intellect which has grasped it. Derech Moshe, for example, Kesheodom meivin umesig ezu halocha b'mishnah b'gemara, la'ashuro, al-bovia. If a person understands a halocha in the Mishnah or the Gemara, and he understands it with clarity, absolute clarity, harei sichloi tofes umakif oiso, then his mind has grasped it and surrounded it, encompassed it. What is this concept which he has grasped? This is the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam, this is the will of God, which a human mind has now grasped and encompassed. For God desired that if a man called Reuven claims such and such, Derech Moshe, for example, the Shimon kach v'kach, and another man called Shimon counters the claim with such and such an argument. Yiye hapsak b'neim kach v'kach. Then the decision is such and such. Va'afim lo yoyo v'lo yiyad over azi. And this is the important part. Says the Baal HaTanya, and even if this case will never come to be, it's purely theoretical. There is no man claiming, and there is no man being claimed from, and never will be. Nevertheless, since that is the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam, sheim yitun zeh kach v'kach, that if one argues this way, v'zeh kach, and the other one the other way, yiyah psak kach, then the decision, the psak din is such and such. Harei kesheodom yudea u'masig b'sichle psak zeh kehalocha ha'aruchu b'mishnah gemara u'poskim. When a man has grasped and understood this halacha, that he understands the claim of Reuven, and he understands the claim of Shimon, and he understands how the Torah analyzes these claims and decides the matter, even though there's no Reuven and there's no Shimon, harezeh masig v'toifes u'makif b'sichloi rotzoino v'chokhmoso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, de'les machshava tfisabe, v'lo b'rotzoino v'chokhmoso. What has he grasped? He's grasped the very will of the Ribbono Shel Olam, which will no intellect is capable of grasping. It's a very anomalous situation. V'hu yichud niflo, and that is an amazing unity. She'en yichud kamoyu, there's no greater unity between man and God than can be achieved at moments of learning. That's the greatest synthesis, that's the closest we can come, the greatest intimacy we can reach to God. That's an area which is barred to the non-Jewish world. It doesn't exist. The closest, the most intimate that the non-Jew comes to God is when he prays, when he talks to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But we can come closer. We can listen when the Ribbono Shel Olam talks to us and understand and grasp. V'zois ma'alo yaseiro g'doylo v'niflo le'in keitz, and this is a wonderful advantage great and wondrous without an end, asher b'mitzvahs yediyas ha-Torah v'asagoso, unique to the mitzvah of knowing the Torah and understanding it, al kol ha-mitzvahs ma'asiyus, with all the actual mitzvahs. He goes on to say that not only does the intellect grasp God, but God really is in one's midst. He's right inside one, so to say, when one has grasped godliness itself. How does that work? Says the Baal HaTanya also. Ve'afta HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nikro Ein Sof, even though God is called infinite, can't grasp him. Ulegadlusoi Ein Cheker, and to his greatness there is no analysis that can match it up and understand it. Ve'les Machshova Tfisabei, and no intellect can grasp him klal at all. Likewise, no intellect can grasp his will and his wisdom. Kidichtiv, as it says, Ein Cheker Litvunosoi, there's no understanding of his wisdom, and so on. Nevertheless, Chazal have said about this, in the very place where you find God's infinite greatness, there you will find his modesty. And that concept the Baal HaTanya learns as the concept of Tzimtzum. Several years ago, we spoke about Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum means contraction, where the Ribbono Shel Olam is able to contract the infinite into the finite. Amazing idea. That something which is totally beyond our grasp because it's infinity, the Ribbono Shel Olam contracts and puts into a finite manifestation. V'tzimtzem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ratzoino V'chochmosoi, and the Ribbono Shel Olam has contracted his wisdom, his will and his wisdom, V'tariag Mitzvahs HaTorah U'V'Hilchoseihem, into the 613 heads of categories of mitzvahs of the Torah and their branches and their subcategories and so on. Which is what it means when Chazal say, Ein loy la'kodesh baruch hu elo dalad amoy shel halacha bilvad. The Ribbono Shel Olam only has in this world the four defined cubits of halacha. Halacha is defined. It has absolute definition, absolute clarity. Philosophy is an undefined subject. Kabbalah is an undefined subject. Medrash is an undefined subject. Halacha is absolutely defined. If your kiddush cup is a half a cc too small, you haven't been yotzei your kiddush. If your esrog is not quite as it should be, you haven't been yotzei your mitzvah of lulav and esrog. It works with absolute clear mathematical definitions. And you're either in or you're out. It's black and white halacha. One can get to Midas Chasidus, one can get to Hidurim, then one can go further. But the basis of halacha is absolutely black and white. And ours is the only religion which not only unashamedly, but proudly says that in those absolute definitions of halacha lies the Ribbono Shel Olam's only real interest. Why? Because he has contracted himself into those halachas. That's God. That's the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when we understand those halachas, we are understanding and grasping the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. That's what the Torah is. The Torah is the contraction of something infinite, that's godliness, into a finite set of relationships and functions and equations which can be mastered by any Jew and has to be mastered by every Jew. Which means we, with our limitations, are able to grasp and master the infinite. As long as you leave it undefined, it remains infinite. As long as you leave it without clear mathematical descriptions and definitions and boundary lines, it will remain infinite. In order to make it graspable and conceivable to the human being, it needs to be contracted into clear definition. And that the Ribbono Shel Olam, his wisdom, did and made the Torah. The Torah is God in a form which can be grasped by the human being. That's what the Torah is. Think about that. When we think that that's what the Torah is, one can get a little shaken up as to what it is that we're busy learning. and how we should be learning and how we should relate to our learning. I often say there used to be a time, I'm told, where at Wits University, believe it or not, students never came to a lecture without their jackets and ties. I'm told it wasn't so long ago. And particularly in the medical school, I'm told that was the case. But in other faculties too. Have a look around today. You're lucky if they come with clothes on today. Certainly when one comes to learn Torah, once one understands, once one begins to grasp what Torah is the Ribbono Shel Olam. Torah is not a book. Torah is not a wisdom, a chokhmah. Torah is the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's the closest we can come to dealing with God Himself. Can you imagine how we should get dressed before we come to learn? We should go to the mikveh. We should get dressed. Wash our hands again before we come to learn. Sit down, the COVID rosh. It's the way it should be. The reason we don't insist on it is because we're afraid that nobody will come to learn if one insists on it. But that doesn't mean that that isn't the way it's supposed to be. That is the way it's supposed to be. That's Torah. A perfectly unique, unitary, closed system which functions with absolute perfection. And the Midrash says, "Istakel b'oraisu v'ro olma." The Ribbono Shel Olam, when He created the world, used the Torah as the plan. That means it wasn't a situation where you had a ganav and a nignav, somebody stealing and somebody stolen from, and the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't like what he saw, so he created the Torah with a law, leisigzel, you shall not steal. That isn't how it worked. The Ribbono Shel Olam created the law leisigzel, that you shall not steal, because you need to understand that law if a human being is going to grasp the Ribbono Shel Olam. There is a part of godliness which can be expressed only in the hypothetical case of a human being who steals from another human being, how you get it back, and paying double, and paying four and five times, and the difference between a ganav and a gazlan. All those laws need to be grasped in order to understand one of the many aspects of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Just as one needs to understand the laws of the korbanos, the sacrifices, and one needs to understand the laws of Tumah and Taharah, and one needs to understand the laws of Tefillah, and one needs to understand the laws of Shabbos, and of Yom Tov, and of Kashrus, and of all sorts of things. You need to understand all the halachas which constitute the Torah in order to be able to grasp God Himself. But it's within our grasp, we can do it. And that all existed long before there were people to steal from one another, long before there were people to murder one another, long before there were trees that could make it, that could produce an esrog. Before there was such a tree, there was a law that you had to take an esrog on Sukkot. Before there was a sun and a moon which could determine days and seasons and months, there wasn't such a thing as a Nisan or a Tishrei. Long before that, there was already a law what you shall do on the 15th of Nisan and what you shall do on the 15th of Tishrei. That there's a Sukkot and that there's a Pesach and a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur. Long before anybody did anything wrong, before there was anybody to do anything wrong, there were the laws of Teshuvah, of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Kippur, of Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. All existed already. Why? Because you needed to understand. That was the way that the Ribbono Shel Olam found to create relationships which will explain godliness to a human being. That was the way it's needed. And then the Ribbono Shel Olam made the world to fit in with that. He looked in the Torah and he said, it says, lo yisigzo, you mustn't steal from one another. That means I've got to create people with a desire for one another's property, which means I've got to create property and I've got to make it attractive. And for people to want to steal each other's property, there must be a limited amount of property, and people will have to work in order to get the property. And the whole system is created just to give expression to lo yisigzo. And so with each of the halachas, there's a sukkah, and I've got to create trees for schach, and I've got to create a palm tree, and I've got to create an esrog tree, and I've got to create a hadas, and a arove. All these things have to be created in order that Jews will be able to act out the mitzvahs, the halachas of sukkah. That the system existed long before the world. The world was created in order to fit in with the system. But what for? Why did the world have to be created? This brings us back to our original question. Just to give us nisoyon? Just to try and test us? No, more than that. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us to perform the one job that he, Kibiyochel, couldn't do. And that is to bring the Torah from potential to actual. And why, so to say, could he not do it? So to say, because obviously he could do anything. In terms of our understanding, we can't perceive how that would have been achieved. Because to bring something from potential to actual, you need imperfection. Because if it's perfection, if there's perfection, there is no difference between the potential and the actual. The difference is only when there's imperfection. Then the potential has to be brought to the surface. But if there's no difference between, if there's perfection, then there's no difference between potential and actual. To create movement in the world, you need to overcome the forces of gravity and the forces of friction. But if there was no force of gravity and there was no force of friction, it wouldn't be a chokhmah to create perpetual movement, never mind movement. You know, just give it a shove and off it goes. A person's potential is only expressed when pressure is applied. And he finds himself in a situation which doesn't match up to his potential. For example, you can find somebody, say, who's a genius, but he doesn't really have to express that genius, because he's a genius even if he does nothing with it. And if everybody was a genius like him, the whole world was a genius like him, he certainly wouldn't have to do anything. It's only because he's living in an imperfect world that he's put under the pressures and the strains, and society is put under the pressure that demands certain things from him, and that brings out the best in him. But if there was no demand, if there was no pressure, there would be no expression of the potentials which he possesses. In the Ribbono Shel Olam's world up there, that's a world of perfection. Everything there is perfect. And therefore the Torah cannot come to perfection. You remember when the angels, the Medrash says, when the angels questioned God as to why he was giving the Torah to the human beings, questioned Moshe, why have you come to take the Torah? Leave it here. Moshe said, what does it say in the Torah? It says, Lo Sigzel, you mustn't steal from one another. Do you people steal up here? Do you angels steal from one another? What have you got to steal? There's no property here. It says, Lo Tirtach, you mustn't murder. You mustn't murder. Do you murder one another? Can you murder? It's not possible. You cannot give expression to the Torah. Your world is perfect. The only place the Torah can be given expression to is down there on that imperfect world. There we can give expression to the Torah, not here. That's what the Torah was designed for. Imagine the Torah as a transparency with a diagram on it. And imagine God's world as a piece of paper with the same diagram on it. And imagine that the Torah's, the transparency, is exactly on top of the piece of paper, so that you can't see two lines. They match perfectly. The two diagrams are exactly the same proportions and they match perfectly. That's how it is up there. You can't notice the Torah, in a sense. The Torah doesn't stand out. It's not three-dimensional, because it fits in so perfectly to the background against which it's set. But imagine that same transparency placed against the background where the lines aren't quite straight. Imagine on the transparencies the angles are exact and the lines are perfectly straight. And now you put that transparency against a diagram which to the naked eye looks exactly the same. You look at the two diagrams, they look exactly the same. You measure them with a ruler, they look exactly the same. You can't see any difference in dimensions. That you take that transparency and you put it over the paper, and all of a sudden you see two lines, not one line. It doesn't fit in exactly. And you now have to start readjusting the diagram on the paper until it perfectly lines up with the diagram on the transparency. then you're doing something with the transparency. Then you're able to perceive the lines on the transparency. They stand out. You can see what has to be done. You can measure them against imperfection and adjust the imperfection to those lines. That's what Torah does down on this world. One takes the Torah, which is perfect, and one puts it against a backdrop, which is imperfect. And now there are one of two ways before us. We either have to adjust the Torah to the imperfection of the world, or we have to do our utmost to adjust the world to the perfection of the Torah. And that is the role of the Jew. To take the world and to readjust it, to realign it as far as he can to match up to the Torah. And that's how the Jew is able to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. We can increase sanctity. We can take this sanctity, we can create Kedusha. Can we create Kedusha? The Medrash asks, how can we create Kedusha? Yes, we can. By adjusting the world to the Torah, by taking the lines of the Torah and taking that as our norm, and imposing the system of the Torah on the world and adjusting the world to the Torah, we can actually create Kedusha in a place where it wasn't before. That we can do. We can build a Mishkan, we can build a Mikdash, we can create a Shul, a Beis HaMedrash, we can create Kedusha, we can write a Sefer Torah. There are things we can do to actually create Kedusha, to create sanctity, by realigning the lines of the backdrop to the transparency. And what happens if we don't do that? What happens if we look at the transparency and we leave the lines unaligned? Then we have confusion, then you can't see what's what. Because the transparency doesn't exist separate. The transparency either exists in God's world, or it exists down here, but it's always got to be viewed against the backdrop. You can't see anything unless it's transparent. You can't see anything unless it's viewed against the backdrop. And unless the lines line up, you don't know which line is the transparency and which line is the paper behind it. So you don't know which is perfection and which is imperfection. You look at it, you can't see, there's confusion. Can you imagine such a situation where you're looking at your diagram, and you're looking at it from a distance, it's against the paper, and you see two lines everywhere, you see two angles. Who's going to know which is the perfect one and which isn't? So you're left with a distorted picture of what perfection is. Let's now go back to our Midrash. There are two important yesodas, two important principles in this Midrash. Wondrously important. Says the Medrash, Kol mi shelomad divrei Torah ve'eino mekayim ein shei chomer mi shelo lomad kolika. Anybody who's learnt the words of Torah and doesn't observe, his punishment is worse than one who's never learnt. Lamad avadoyme, what can this be compared to? Lamelech shoyolo pardes, a king who had an orchard. Hichnis l'toichei shnei adisim, and he put into the orchard two managers, two gardeners. Echad yonotea ilonos mekatzon. One was planting trees and chopping them down, and one didn't plant at all. And he wasn't chopping down. Who does the king get angry? Not surely at the one who's planting and chopping down. He's the one the king gets angry with, not the one who's doing nothing. The first principle here is that exactly the same relationship which exists between a fully grown tree, beautifully green with all its leaves, beautiful blossoms, fully laden with gorgeous fruit, that on the one side, and the little sapling on the other side. That same relationship is the relationship between the learning of a Torah thought and the practicing of it. These are not two different things. One would tend to think, trained as we are with secular thinking, that it's better to have learnt and lost than never to have learnt at all. At least what I learnt, I have. Good, I didn't practice it, but I still know. No, says the Midrash, you would have been better off not learning. Because we cannot separate the learning from the action. That's principle number one, which we'll come back to in a moment. Principle number two is that decadence of destructiveness is not because of the result. The decadence of destructiveness is because of the action. The results are the same in both cases. There's no tree. The one never planted one, and the one planted and destroyed. So the result is the same. There's no tree in either case. Why does the king get more angry with the one who chopped down? Because it was a maaseh hashchosa. It was an act of destructiveness. That's why he gets angry. He gets angry with the nature of the action, not with the result. The result is no trees, okay, that's bad enough. But the results are the same. Except one achieved the results by inactivity, no construction, no destruction. And the other constructed, but then he destroyed what he constructed. We tend to think that we are balabatim, that we are masters of our own creations. I made it, I can do what I want with it. The answer is no, you can't. You made it, that was an act of creation. But once you've created something, you cannot destroy, because destructiveness is negative. No matter what you destroy, even if it's something which you made, you can't destroy it and say the result is the same. If I made it, I can do what I want with it. You can't. Can't destroy. That's why one has to be very careful before one creates things, and one has to be even more careful after one's created things. One has to be sure that what one has created, one is willing to keep. It's worth keeping. And secondly, the act of creation imposes an enormous responsibility on a human being. A person builds up a business, he can't just neglect it and let it run down. A person builds up an educational institution, can't just neglect it and let it run down. I built it, I'm letting it run down. What's the difference? It'll be as it was before. You can't just do that. There's a maaseh hashchosa, there's an act of destructiveness. Likewise, when one has learnt something, has learnt a halacha, one goes through the sugya, let's say, that deals with mezuzahs. What kind of door needs a mezuzah? What a mezuzah is, first of all. How you write a mezuzah. What parsha has to be written. With what parchment and with what ink it has to be written. The source of mezuzah. Where it comes from. All the different halachas. What kind of door needs a mezuzah? On what side of the door do you place the mezuzah? At what height do you place the mezuzah? At what angle do you place the mezuzah? What bracha do you make on the mezuzah when you put it on? And so on and so forth. All the halachas you've gone through. The Shulchan Aruch, the Noisei Kelim, the Gemoras, the Rambam. You've gone through the whole thing. That's the sapling. You've planted a little tree already. That's not complete. You haven't finished your job. It's true that if you were still up in the world of the Ribono Shel Olam with the angels there, where there are no doors, you will have finished your job. There are no doors, so there are no mezuzahs. All you've done is learnt and grasped the principle of mezuzah. And that's very important, because as we learnt in the Baal HaTanya, that means you've grasped a piece of godliness. You've absorbed it into yourself. Your mind has encompassed a concept which is the will of the Ribono Shel Olam. That's a wonderful achievement. But the chiddush of the medrash is that's just the sapling, because you're living down here. And until you've knocked the mezuzah onto the door, the tree hasn't grown into full strength yet. That, firstly, is the primary difference between the wisdom of the goyim, between secular knowledge and Torah knowledge. With us, knowledge is full of potential. Knowledge is like a pregnancy, waiting for a birth. In secular knowledge, it's not so. The knowledge is already the whole thing. There's nothing more to it but the knowledge. If you know something, you know it, finished. It doesn't have to be practiced. There is very often no way of practicing it. There's no form of expression that can be given to it very often. You know it, you've grasped it, that's enough. With us, it's not so, because you remember the Torah is a transparency that needs a backdrop. And it either has to have the backdrop of God's perfect world, where the lines are automatically aligned, or it has to have the backdrop of this world, where the lines are not aligned. And the fact is, we're down here on this world, and you can't just look at the transparency, you won't see anything. So you put it against the backdrop, and there all of a sudden is a door, and you've got the lines exactly the same. There's one line, and there's the mashkoi from the top. One mezuzah down here, one mezuzah down here, one doorpost, the other doorpost. Matches perfectly, except for one thing. On your transparency, there's a little protrusion on the one doorpost. That protrusion is called a mezuzah. Whereas on the other one, on the paper, you don't see it. Now what do? Do you leave it, or do you correct the paper so that it should align absolutely? The Medrash says, not only must you correct the paper, but if you don't correct the paper, you've destroyed the transparency. Because now you're looking at the one, and you don't know which is which. The lines aren't matched up, and reality is being confused. You can't see what's what. The lack of expression of a Torah concept destroys the concept. It doesn't leave the concept intact. This is like the gardener who comes and has planted the tree. You've learned through all the halachas of the mezuzah, and now you've got a chance. There's your door, no mezuzah. And you do nothing about it. You're destroying your knowledge. It's not that your knowledge remains intact. This is the sapling. You've planted the tree already, and now by not putting it into practice, it's like taking an axe and chopping that tree down. You're destroying. The knowledge is becoming weakened. The knowledge is dying. Again, it's like a pregnancy. And you decide it doesn't suit you yet to have the baby born. Sometimes it doesn't suit the doctors to have the baby born at 5 hours or on days when they're supposed to play golf. But they found the kunz. They bring the day earlier. They induce the birth. And imagine if you had a doctor who's even more foolish than that, and he wants to delay the birth. I'm playing golf on Wednesdays, he says, so let's delay the birth till Thursday. What will happen? The baby will die. You can't delay. When the fetus is ready to come from potential into actuality, if you don't allow it to happen, the fetus is no more. You've destroyed it. It's a living thing. It's not an object. And a piece of Torah knowledge is like a fetus. It's a living fetus. It's growing. It's developing. It's waiting to be born. The moment of birth is when an opportunity comes to bring it from potential into actuality. We're busy playing golf at that time. Missed the opportunity. The concept is there. You killed it. It is no more. You've been distracted, not neglected. You've been distracted. The concept is no more. It's blown cold. You've lost it. Tremendous energy builds up when you learn the halachah. And you go through the concept, and you go through the reasoning, and you go through the background, and all its different facets. You look at it from this side and from that side. Tremendous energy builds up. That energy lasts until the point where you have an opportunity to express it. When you've got that opportunity, you either express it, and then that energy is translated into the mezuzah on your door. Every time you look at that mezuzah, you touch that mezuzah, you see and you're enthused with all the energy that went into the expression of those halachas in that very mezuzah. But if there is no mezuzah there, all that energy from the learning, from the understanding, from the analysis is totally dissipated. It's gone, it's flat, it's finished. And you've destroyed the concept. That is the uniqueness of Torah. When one learns a piece of secular knowledge, it doesn't create an enormous energy within one that needs to be expressed. It doesn't do that. It doesn't require to come out in the form of a mitzvah, in the form of an action. When one learns a Torah concept, it does. One understands now, you know, there's a minhag that during the benching, people put their knives away. They take the knives off the table. That's based on the story of the man who, when he came from the benching to the section of Bnei Yerushalayim, Irakodesh, B'meir of Yomenu, where we pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam to rebuild Yerushalayim, he became so depressed that he actually took his knife and stabbed himself. And it's difficult for us to picture such a thing. Why would such a person do such a thing? But if you can imagine that the person might have been learning Kodshim before he sat down at the meal. He might have been learning that section of the Gemara that deals with Beis Hamikdash, with Korbonos, with Yerushalayim, the Kedusha of Yerushalayim. And all this energy is building up inside. And he sits down to his meal. Fine, he relaxes a little bit while he's sitting. He's still going through a difficult Rambam, which he's trying to resolve. And then he benches, eager to get back to his learning. And the reality of the situation suddenly hits him in the Bnei Yerushalayim. All this, and I can't express it. There is no Yerushalayim. There is no Beis Hamikdash. There's no Mizbeach. There's no Kabbalah. What am I going to do with all this energy? One can picture the enormity of that frustration and energy which resulted in the unfortunate suicide. That's the energy, that's the degree of energy which is built up and which can be built up when one's busy with the halacha. And it can be stored up and accumulated until the moment comes to actually put it into practice. But if one lets that moment pass, then it's verfallen. Then one's dissipated it totally, and one's starting again from scratch. You've taken spiritual energy. You've taken that mitzvah of the Torah, that godliness which you encompassed, which was inside you, and you've allowed it to escape. You've destroyed it totally. That applies in all the areas of halacha. We've started now a shiur on Monday evenings to learn the halachas of Lashon Hara and to learn the halachas of Chesed. Same thing. One goes through the Chofetz Chaim and one learns, whether it's Lashon Hara or Chesed, how to do a kindness, when to do a kindness, the sources of the halachas, the different situations, this way, that way. One masters the concepts and principles. There builds up inside one a tension, a need to take that potential out and to express it in practice. And if one can, then that godliness is preserved in the form of that mitzvah. If one allows the opportunity to move away, to pass, then that godliness is dissipated, that energy is gone. We cannot divorce our learning from our actions. And with this understanding of this wonderful medrash, we can understand the Gemara in Kiddushin and Daf Mem Amud Beis, where the Gemara says, "Ufaroyo Rabbi Tarfon is a Zakenim Mesubim Ba'aliyas Beis Nitzalza Belud." Rabbi Tarfon and the Zakenim were already having a meal once in the attic of Beis Nitzalza in Lud. Nish Olo She'ilo Zu Bifneim, and they were asked the following shaila: Talmud Godol or Maise Godol? What is greater, to learn or to do? Is the mitzvah greater or the understanding of the mitzvah greater? Nani Rabbi Tarfon, v'omar Maise Godol. Rabbi Tarfon said the action is greater. Nani Rabbi Akiva, v'omar Talmud Godol. Rabbi Akiva said learning is greater. And the debate ensued. Nanu Kulam v'omru, then everybody there finally voted for Rabbi Akiva. Talmud Godol, learning is greater. Why? Sha Talmud mevi lidei Maise. Because learning brings one to action. Why does learning bring one to action? Is that so, that learning brings one to action? Aren't there many things that we know and don't do? Sure, there are many things we know and don't do. That's not called learning. To know that there's a halacha that you've got to keep Shabbos, that's not called learning. But to take Masechta Shabbos and work through it from beginning to end, with every Rashi and with every Tosfos, with Rambam, with Turim Shulchan Aruch, and to master Shabbos in all its halachas, there is such an energy after that. You can't wait for the next Shabbos. You can't wait for shailas, for problems and situations to come up. You want the imperfections. You crave the imperfections. Because that gives you a chance to align those imperfections up to your Masechta Shabbos, to the learning which you did, to the understanding which you achieved, to introduce Kedusha in the world and to take all that knowledge and bring it to potential. There's an enormous drive inside one to do it. It's mevi lidei maase. It brings one to do it. It motivates one. It energizes one to action. It's not just that you know what to do. That's not what he means. What the Chazal mean is this mevi lidei maase. It is a pregnancy. The natural consequence of which is maase. It is action. As long as you don't let the opportunity go. And it's interesting, in fact, that the word for pregnancy is horo, hei reish hei. And the source, the root of the word toiro is also horo, which means to teach. It's the same thing, the teaching of toiro, the unique teaching of toiro as opposed to chokhma, is a teaching which isn't ended with the teaching. Passing on the information is not what toiro learning is about. Absorbing, understanding, mastering, grasping, even though it's God himself which we're mastering and grasping, that's still not the end of the action. For all that could have been done upstairs before we were born. We could have remained as spirits without a body, living in that perfect world, and we could have grasped and understood it all. In fact, we could have grasped and understood it all better there than here. The only thing we couldn't have done there was put it into practice. Take those concepts and express them. Make them work. That we couldn't have done. It's like the physicist who works out, spends a lifetime working out a theory. And eventually he's worked it out. All the equations match up and balance and things work out. And now he's got to go into the laboratory to try it out. To see if it really works. We don't have to try it out to see if it really works. We know it really works. But the learning, the thinking, the reasoning is not complete until we've gone into the laboratory to actually do it. The world is the laboratory of the Torah. That's what it is. The world was designed as a laboratory with all the equipment needed to try every experiment that there is in the Torah. Whatever case is described in the Torah, whatever will of the Ribbono Shel Olam is expressed through the words of the Torah, can find expression in some form or another in the world around us, in this laboratory in which we live. The learning is pregnant and it needs to be given birth. Only we can give that birth. Only we are capable of taking that learning, that enormous energy which develops if our learning is proper, if our learning is fundamental, if our learning is deep and stimulating. Only then will that energy be developed inside us. And only we as living human beings in an imperfect world can take that energy and by aligning the imperfections of the world around us to the perfection of the Torah can give expression and can bring those wonders of the Torah from potential into reality. Min HaKoyach El HaPoel.